This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, folks, let's get started. Are we recording? Good. All right, Alex.
Yeah.
Anna.
She'll be about 15 minutes late.
Okay. Casey.
Here.
Rita.
Here.
Elena.
Elizabeth.
Here.
Ian.
Here.
Justin.
We'll also be about 15 minutes late for unrelated reasons.
Okay. Jonathan.
Here.
Julia.
Here.
Lucia.
Here.
Janisha.
Here.
Margaret J.
Here.
Margaret M.
Here.
Sarah.
Here.
Tasia.
Here.
Todd.
Here.
Rachel.
Out of cue.
Nice. Okay, approval of the minutes. All right, is there any dissent to approving the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. And now to our first presenter, Dean of the Faculty, Charlie Van Loon.
For giving me a chance to talk to you about the academic calendar. So it's a pretty hot topic when you start talking about changing it. So it's a tricky business. There was a calendar committee from 2010 to 2012 that gave us what we call now the current calendar. And it's one of the few, I think it's actually the best event in the following sense. It's the one thing that involves students, faculty, staff, alumni, trustees. Everyone has a stake in it. Everyone has strong opinions about it. So if we do it right, to me it's a so-called teaching moment, because you get to see how some of these other constituencies think about stuff. Anyways, we have a whole website on this, and we're going to publicize it fairly soon, and you can do things there. But what we've done is crystallize the questions that we should all ask about the calendar. Now, roughly speaking, consensus is the fall calendar is okay. Okay. The spring calendar, however, it seems to have some flaws in it. So let me sort of outline some of the things that we're looking for input from you. So, for example, the staging of the finals week. We have that study day that's right in the middle of the 8 exam days. Does that work? Spacing between the end of class to the first exam. Spacing between the end of your, between the in the intersession is a big deal, especially for international students who may want to go home. A little bit more on the spring semester. Basically, people feel the positioning of the February break is kind of pointless. It comes too early to have any stress component to it. Incidentally, there doesn't seem to be a theory of breaks. In other words, we all intuitively think we need breaks, but when it comes to positioning them and how do you optimize, there's nothing really written down on it. But getting back to the spring semester, think about the 2-week February break and then the 1-week spring break, and can we position those better? Should we do away with the February break? For example, I think Binghamton has 2 1-week breaks breaking up their semester. Anyway, there's a whole ton of questions here, 13 of them or so, or 10 of them, and if you click on them, you're taken to a page where you can leave a comment. Okay, you can leave a comment. And so we want to collect all these things. Our committee, and Rena is on the committee, wants to sort of gather data and thoughts about the calendar during the fall semester here, and then it will sort of figure things out early in the spring. It runs through one of the Senate committees, and then it'll perhaps show up in the Senate as crystallized as a resolution to do X, Y, or Z. Now, here's something I want to say especially about it for you, and I only thought about this weekend. Clearly, as graduate students, you have things to say about this. But a lot of you are TAs, so you get to see up close undergraduates going about their business in classes. So that would be extremely valuable if you could draw on that experience, and maybe you have some thoughts about the February break as seen through the eyes of, say, the undergraduates that you work with. So that's it in a nutshell. When the current calendar was formed back in 2012, part of the deal was that it should be reevaluated at the five-year point, and that's right now. The last part, and this might be a stretch, but on the table is the possibility of shifting the entire spring semester earlier. And we can't do it 1 week because Ithaca College has its graduation on the weekend before Memorial Day. So on the table is the possibility of shifting the entire spring semester earlier. The motivation for that is, one of them, is student jobs in the summer, okay, giving you 2 more weeks of employment, for example. We end very late. The most popular time for commencement is the weekend, is Ithaca College's day, the weekend before Memorial Day, okay? On this website, we have maybe a dozen or so calendars of related schools. You can compare how they position their break, when they start, when they finish. So a lot of information there. As an aside, it's kind of an interesting problem. So if we think about moving commencement 2 weeks earlier, what's the difference in weather? What's the probability of thunderstorms on the two possible commencement dates? What's the cost of 2 extra weeks of heating in the dorms, right? It's amazing all the different factors that come up. But with time, this is an aside here, the chances of shifting the semester while it's on the table, and the provost, who's the final arbiter in all this, says, by all means, consider it, because we really should look at it fair and square. The last calendar committee started to look at it, and they were blocked midstream when they were told it's this off the table. So it's not off the table, just from the scientific point of view. Let's look at it and see what's up. I've talked enough. Any questions, any shoot-from-the-hip comments on the current calendar and maybe some of the changes that I just sort of outlined there that might come down the pipe? So you guys have a systematic way of...
Just you can call on people yourself.
Regarding the changes that we plan to make, would
possible
changes, would shifting the spring semester affect the schedule of thesis submission deadlines?
Wow, that I don't know. It's a rigid movement of the whole semester. So whatever your deadline is now, how the schedule would be 2 weeks earlier. But I'm not sure.
Because I know a lot of graduate students sort of aim for the last possible day, which is like for a 2017 thesis submission is like July 30th or something.
Okay.
Like that. And I'm wondering if changes in the spring semester would affect the that sort of
that's an important detail, but my preliminary thinking is everything, whatever the deadline is now, would be 2 weeks early. That's a grad school thing, I guess, and I couldn't really say definitely. Yeah.
So I'm a DA for a lab section in chemistry, and a problem that we have with the spring semester is our labs, they occur throughout the entire week. However, each semester, you start on a different day other than Monday, and you also end on a different day other than Friday. So we actually lose 2 weeks of labs, so we have to squeeze more labs in a short period of time. And we found that to be quite stressful for the students. And I understand maybe shifting could possibly help, but I'm wondering why do we lose so many days?
And after you have a calendar, you propose a calendar, then you count how many Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays you have. And in the spring semester, I forget who it was, but there's one that's 15 and one that's 13, and so you're probably lowest common denominator, and so on, if you have 5 days of lab. So that is very definitely the whole lab scene, and we have people on the committee who are big lecture lab type people, to make sure we pay attention to that dimension. Because, again, if you don't have symmetry, you know what I'm talking about. If you do it wrong, you'll lose a week of lab because you can't manage it otherwise. So that's a real important attribute, lab.
How do you guys plan on fixing that? Because the person that I work for is Tom Rutledge, and he has consistently advocated for either lengthening the beginning of semester so it starts on Monday so that they gain more time to do the labs.
So tell your colleagues. supposed to come up. Here's a creative solution that was dismissed because it's too complicated. To even out things, you might do something like this. Hey, we're starting class on a Tuesday, but between you and me, it's really a Monday. So you would have a Tuesday class, but act as if it's Monday. So some schools do that. You follow what I'm saying?
I understand, but that doesn't work if we have a Monday afternoon lab and a Tuesday morning lab.
Okay, now you're getting too complicated for me. But it's a very important constraint that we have to take in.
So hold on, can I just say, make sure you leave that comment on the website and also talk to Rena first. Rena's over there too. And so make sure that's your two avenues to get your concerns out as well. So leave a comment on the website and talk to Rena. There's also one up in the back. There's a question up in the back.
Right? Yeah.
So I was an undergraduate in 2012 when the new calendar change that exists right now was implemented, much to the disdain of
it's ready to go. One, the last little bit I'll probably figure out tomorrow. There's an email address, academiccalendar@cornell.com. You can send in things that way too. But I think the goal is by the end of the semester, like December 2nd, is what I told the employees. It'd be great to have all the input by then. That way, we can keep to our timeline. The last committee took 2 years, and we just don't want to do that. So we have to move at a certain clip. And what I don't want to have happen is big splash at the beginning, lull, and then announcements like in March, and then people saying, "Oh, you didn't consult me," or whatever. We're going to be in everybody's face from start to finish, making sure you know about this, that we're collecting thoughts on the calendar. So it's nonstop, but I would sort of say the next 5 weeks.
So follow up to that, you want us to start pushing this
sure.
on our social media now, or are you waiting for like a
No, it's not like some, no, now, just pile this stuff in, you know, and you know, the idea is to learn from one another, and as I said, it is a teaching moment, because you're going to see employees looking at things rather different than you, you're going to see faculty looking at things different than you, but if we do it right, it'll be educational, yeah.
Hi, great that you're reaching out to them and trying to get our thoughts on that stuff. I just wanted to know if there was, other than the anecdotal evidence that possibly people would provide, is there any way to gauge the effectiveness when you break for?
As I said, there's no break theory. In other words, you can't sit down and find a huge educational journal that's done a study on breaks. Here's what I did do like about a month ago. I went over to Gannett and talked to Greg Gill, who runs the mental health side of the operation, and I said, hey, let's look at visits to Gannett as a function of where we are in the semester. And let's look at it like last year and then like 5 years ago with the old calendar. And I was expecting to see, you know, dips and then, oh, here's a break and it has a tremendous impact. It's total noise. You cannot spot from the visits to Gannett data the value of breaks. It doesn't show up at all. In fact, the kind of a peak is the first week of class because there's so many anxious first time students on campus. Yeah.
So I guess one of the values I noticed since like being a third year is that the almost like exams have like Saturday and Sunday the exam.
Yeah.
And I mean for like several other universities, like my undergrad and like some of my other friends, you know, their university, you know, it seems like a very weird option.
going to some of the central offices just to see what things are from their perspective. Back up.
To talk and we'll stay in touch. And Rena is your representative. And good.
Thinking about some Robert's Rules type stuff that could help us. I think that if we do too much Robert's Rules type formality, it could really hinder us, and we don't want that. But there could be some things that we pick that would be nice. In organizations that follow Robert's Rules, there are usually a constitution or charter, which we have, bylaws, which we have, and something called standing rules, which is a thing that we currently don't have. And so we have this kind of option in front of us to create another governing document, which is a little scary, especially if you're trying to minimize the amount of bureaucracy that you're dealing with. But on the other hand, if it's really short and has like 5 rules in it, it could help us to make our meetings run more smoothly. So in my copious spare time, I'm going to be looking into creating something like this, and I want to solicit comments from people on what would be good and what would be not good. The things that I am thinking of right now are putting in a standing rule that whenever anybody makes a motion, they automatically shift into what Robert's Rules would term as speech, which is essentially their presentation, which is a thing that we already do, but I just want to formalize that, and say that at the end of it, there is an automatic question and answer period. And the automatic question and answer period serves two useful functions. One is that, again, we kind of already do this, so let's just make it formal. And two don't have a question and answer period built into the end of this speech, this presentation, then what happens is everybody either makes points of inquiry, which circumvents the normal process of people being, you know, of people speaking in turn, and should be used only when there's a real lack of clarity about something and not just when somebody hasn't figured out something about the presentation. And the alternative to that is that people will use their opportunities on the speakers list to ask questions. And this is something to be generally avoided, because it's not really what the speakers list is for. The speakers list is for giving people an opportunity to state what they think and ask the group to think about things, not to ask specific questions, specifically of the speakers, the movements. And it is what tends to get us into this back and forth off the speaker's list, people talking over one another thing, and that's when people tend to either check out or jump in, and that's when our meetings get off the rails and go long, and I know that many of us have been frustrated by business running over recently. So having this official motion, speech, Q&A, and then go into the speaker's list thing would hopefully ameliorate that problem. The other standing rule that I have considered is that we make a standing rule that we automatically go onto a speaker's list either anytime we have a motion under discussion or the first time the chair sees two hands at the same time. Because we also get into trouble when people are, when there isn't an official speaker's list and people are raising their hands and it's not clear whether they're trying to respond to something the chair has said or trying to respond to something somebody else has said. And I think having a speaker's list as soon as there's any question would be good for that. And then we can think about having that automatically have a limit on speaker times, like a 30-second limit or a 60-second limit on speaker times, which is forever once you actually try to use it. If we give this a shot, I think most people will find that they do not need more than about 10 seconds to speak. And if you need 60 seconds to speak, maybe you should think about that. And just as an aside to that, I encourage everybody to think about what they're going to say before they raise their placard, just all the time, so that you can say it quickly and not, hi, yes, I was thinking that maybe, and then you say this in like the least concise way possible, and I think that's something that many of us have been guilty of at some point, and that would be good to avoid. So if anybody has specific questions right now about either these two standing rules or the idea of standing rules in general or Robert's rules in general, feel free to ask. I think it has just occurred to me. I will just send out the cheat sheet to Robert's rules that I found, the best cheat sheet to Robert's rules that I found, because that could also possibly, people could profit by that. So question, yeah.
I just wanted to ask you about how you manage the Q&A work.
Well, the thing with the Q&A is that it's flexible, and you would the speakers, the movements would just run that. So that's on the speakers list, and that lets the movements kind of answer questions in a way that satisfies everybody, not just necessarily the person. Richard.
Perhaps you elaborate on why it's
I don't have super strong feelings on it either way, except that bylaws are explicitly not for things like standing rules are for. Generally bylaws are for things that are like constitution or charter things, except that you want them to be able to be easier to change. And standing rules are for how you do stuff, and you don't. And they're not substantively procedural. Although Julia knows that there's no such thing as a distinction between substance and procedure in life. I think it would be better in some ways to have a new short governing document than having a section tacked onto the long file. But I don't, that's not like deeply in my heart.
Two questions, both building off what I've already asked. One, so the bylaws already have an Article 4 of the bylaws is procedure.
Mm-hmm.
So we already seem to be breaking that distinction in the bylaws as it is. And it sounds like the thing, mm-hmm. just my thought.
Yeah.
And it sounds like the thing you're talking about would fit into that section of the bylaws.
Yeah. First of all, you could argue that we shouldn't have a section on procedure in the bylaws. Second, most of what the section on procedure in the bylaws says is we use Robert's rules in And that is actually the kind of thing that makes sense to have in the bylaw. You want to just say, we use Robert's rules. And then the standing rules are for the things that you want to emphasize or subtract about Robert's rules that allow you to tailor it specifically to your organization. But I think the only thing that we should say procedurally in the bylaws is we use Robert's rules unless specified otherwise by our standing rules.
Okay, and the other question was, so you mentioned that the speakers just have a tendency to include a lot of questions, but Q&As have a tendency to include a lot of questions that aren't questions.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you intend on avoiding that?
One of the responsibilities of the chair in the most formal or original Robert's Rules schema is to relentlessly smack down people who try to phrase statements as questions during Q&A, and also people who ask questions when they're supposed to be speaking. I don't think we really need to do that, although I've also been thinking about the creation of a sergeant at arms position for this assembly. I think we should be able to get on board as an assembly. We're relatively small for a Robert's Rules type group, and we all basically are happy, fun, friendly people. I think we all basically get behind the idea that if there's a time for questions and a time for statements, that we can respect the boundary that we're trying to draw between these two things. And I think we could also even say that if you have a question, but really it's kind of substantively a statement of opinion, then that's okay. Like, if you're asking a rhetorical question on the speaker's list, that's fine. And similarly, if you have a statement that elicits an informative response and you say that during a Q&A, I think that's fine. I think what we're looking at is what's underlying your submission to the forum.
Can we do two quick questions, and then we'll finish up with
cool.
Nietzsche.
So just more on this Q&A thing. So during the Q&A, you imagine that I have people asking questions on like where you got statistics from, or where certain aspects of the resolution came from, or your motivation behind the resolution, while the speaker's list is more along the lines of, this line I have a problem with for these reasons. Is that like more what you see that being as?
Yeah, so if you look at other organizations that use Robert's Rules, the speech is really designed to give the assembly information about the motion, and any information that the speakers fail to provide should be elicited by a question. And then people can say their thoughts during the speaker's list, and they can move and they can explain. Because when you move to amend a resolution or a motion, that automatically gives you a quick speech and a quick Q&A. Robert's Rules formally limits that to two levels of recursion. So your main motion, level one, level two, and that's it. So we don't get too out of hand. Does that answer your question? Cool. And
Alex, thoughts on this?
Yeah.
Two quick things. One, so is this the same thing that the House of Representatives uses or the Senate uses for filibuster cloture, the standing rule?
That's a dangerously worded question. I think one of the functions that a sergeant at arms could fulfill is decapitating people who attempt to filibuster. Figuratively. But the Senate and the House do operate on Robert's Rules, but they do that all the time, not just when they're filibustering or moving for cloture. Yes.
And then my last thing was, considering how I can't remember the last time we had a resolution that we actually read, can we put in there that we are, you could just do a quick summary?
That would be a perfect candidate for a standing rule. Now we have three standing rules.
Awesome. All right.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to move into breakout rooms. Breakout rooms.
Okay, so as per usual, can we have bylaw compliance here? Can we have humanity here?
Thank you. those past couple of years.
There's been some work done on exploring the idea of creating student legal services. So what is student legal services? Essentially, this is a place where you can get free legal advice if you come into a problem not related to Cornell University, because that would be a conflict of interest. This would still be a service provided by Cornell University. So primarily, it would probably address landlord-tenant issues. So if you have a lease that you feel has been violated by your landlord, they can help you with that. Or if your landlord tries to hold on to a security deposit, you feel they're doing so illegally, I guess would be the word, then these people would be able to help you out there. Essentially, it's a lawyer that you can go to for anything not related to Cornell. Lots of other universities have these. My alma mater, University of Florida, had a full-time attorney on staff that was only for students. Like I said, it's been explored for a couple of years. It started out with the undergraduate assembly 2 years ago, and then last year our graduate freshman student trustee, Andy O'Toole, did a lot of work fleshing out a proposal and that actually had a lot of detail in it, a lot of possibilities. And from there, it's kind of not gone anywhere because it's never really been formally produced as a resolution. It has been presented to various administrators to show some support for the idea. So now what we're trying to do is get the ball rolling on things actually implemented. And that's where this ad hoc committee comes in, a group to work on interfacing with administrators on getting it implemented, work with the undergraduate student assembly to get them on board, see about maybe crafting a resolution that both our assemblies could pass, so it'd be the same resolution in both bodies, and sort of try and figure out what from Andy's proposal do we want to keep, do we want to endorse the entire thing as it stands, or do we feel like we need to change it and do a lot more work on it in that regard. So that's sort of the general broad overview of legal services. One thing I will mention is that in the proposal that Andy put together, there was the idea of a $10 opt-out fee. So it is a $10 fee that you'd be automatically enrolled to pay, but you could opt out of it if you didn't want to pay the $10 fee. And if you then needed legal services but had opted out of the fee, there would be some kind of extremely expensive way for you to still access the service, like $500 or something like that, to discourage people from opting out and then trying to use the service, because then everyone just opt out of the same cost to pay for it when they need it. So that's my overview.
Okay, so again, the motion was to create an ad hoc committee to explore creating a student legal services using the template that, the implicit thing is using the template that Annie O'Toole has been working on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The motion has been seconded.
Actually, we're
queuing. We're still queuing it now by our ad hoc committee.
I just wanted to, but you did say that from your $10 option fee, so I guess I'm trying to understand what these lawyers can be used for. You specifically said it can't be for anything related to Cornell. Is it because our money is technically not our money, but it's being Cornell money, even though we're paying for it?
It's a student fee, and it would also be put into a pool with undergraduate student fees. And legalities of it, I'm not sure, but because it's being collected as a fee to the university, it would be funds from Cornell, essentially. So it's almost like paying tuition. And so you couldn't then use that to pay for a lawyer to sue Cornell because it's almost like Cornell paid for it.
But they didn't, though.
I know, but that's where the law stands.
the standard practice is that you can't use the school, the university's student legal services to represent yourself against the university which provides the student.
If we all got together and paid $10 outside of the university to get a lawyer, then that would be something different. But this is, if we want to pay it as a fee to the university that would then provide the service, then it would have these different restrictions on it.
And historically, most of the work that these types of things do are landlord-tenant related. So typically, in the ballpark, 80-90% of their work is landlord-tenant.
What's the follow-up question?
The Q&A.
insurance company, which is what to me that what that sounds like is everyone pays in and you get legal insurance, you get a lawyer whenever you need it. I can only imagine how badly that could go, but the idea is if it's a service we want, if it's a service we want to put together on our own privately away from Cornell, probably something we could do. But really, this is only meant to address issues with Cornell students and the outside world, not with Cornell itself. And in terms of addressing those issues, this would be the most straightforward and easy way to get that done.
What issues between students following the purview?
No, you could not bring a group, like, again, conflict of interest, because you both, in that case, would have paid that $10 fee. Who does legal services person help in that case? It is strictly Cornell, non-Cornell affiliated. So Cornell student, landlord. The interesting question is, some Cornell employees and some Cornell faculty own property and lease them out to students. In that case, it does create an interesting situation, and you probably couldn't use student legal services in order to address the issue. But as part of one of the proposals was, the student legal services would help students find lawyers in the community that could help them out if there was either a conflict of interest or if they felt the case was just too big for them to handle on their own. It's like, this is a multi-year litigation, we just can't handle that. So I saw up there and then we did it.
So,
and then found
like,
me out from my dress. So I don't want to get too much into the specifics of that because, again, the committee is to explore these options, but the proposal put forward by Annie was a legal clinic with law school students providing the services of the legal clinic, and then a local attorney that would be kept on retainer, so the fees would go toward keeping them on retainer and paying for fees as they came up when the lawyer was needed to step in and actually, you know, provide more than that. But yeah, there would be a group of law school students doing a lot of the work, a lot of the day-to-day work, triage, that kind of thing, for people coming in seeking student legal services.
Question about the could this legal services department person provide informal advice or consultation to students that they should have at a university, or does that mean like the conversation? You know, you can't just go into the office and ask.
feedback to the administration, the administration looks to implement it. And that could definitely be one of the questions that's raised, and how can that be addressed? And so that's the other thing, that if anyone has anything that they would... This, I think, is also a helpful discussion for the committee, because the committee will be raising these issues as SLS is conceived, if it does get conceived and does go forward, which is, of course, not a sure thing yet.
All right, seeing that we've exhausted our questions, I'm going to say, first I'm going to try and do this by unanimous consent. If someone's opposed, just say, I'm opposed. Is there anyone opposed to forming the ad hoc committee? Please dissent. Seeing no dissent, we now have a new ad hoc committee to explore student legal services.
some fields have more money than others. But when you're on a health leave of absence, similar to a personal leave of absence, you don't have any student registration. So you're not entitled to student services, but I mean, there's something you can do to have access to the library. And you know, offline or another time, we can talk more about some students take a health leave of absence because they fall into the floor behind with academic requirements because they've been sick and they wait and wait and then they take a health leave.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.